Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, February 9th, 2016. First in the nation primary day in New Hampshire. You say, you're unbelievable. An unbelievable development on the campaign trail in New Hampshire. As Jeb Bush, the guy whose campaign was so dull that he had to abuse the exclamation point to distract you from his last name, he stunned me with a call to overturn the Citizens United decision by the United States Supreme Court. Wow. Now, this is driven by equal parts of desperation and hypocrisy. Jeb Bush is flailing away, dreaming that somehow he could pull out a second place or maybe even a third place finish in the New Hampshire primary after dropping tens of millions of dollars that actually seemed to cause his poll numbers to decline. And Jeb Bush, I mean, this is so rich. He's so rich. He has $118 million in his pack called Right to Rise. And I believe it's a dark money pack that does not disclose its donors. He has four times as much as any other Republican super PAC and three times what Priorities USA Action has raised for Hillary Clinton. But yesterday he said that if I could do it all again, I'd eliminate the Supreme Court ruling. This is a ridiculous system we have now where you have campaigns that struggle to raise money directly and they can't be held accountable for the spending of the super PAC that's their affiliate. Well, Jeb has test-driven the Koch brothers' vehicle called Citizens United and found that, well, it's got a few problems. It's a lemon. And he has had this problem where the super PAC has plenty of money, but his day-to-day campaign fund has been pretty sparse. And ever since Donald Trump entered the picture and started to talk about the low energy that Jeb Bush projects, well, his fundraising has lagged even further. So I welcome Jeb Bush, with or without his exclamation point, to the bandwagon to overturn Citizens United. And this followed, of course, a well-timed meeting in New Hampshire by a group called New Hampshire Rebellion. They brought 700 people into Manchester this past weekend, with the goal of getting big money out of politics. And one of the speakers was Harvard Law professor Larry Lessig, who briefly flirted with his own campaign for president on the single issue of reforming the finance of our campaigns. And Donald Trump is saying, hey, I'm over here, remember me? I have funded my own campaign through the sale of these ugly red hats, and I don't get enough credit for it. And he tweeted, as he always does, he loves Twitter, I don't believe I've been given any credit by the voters for self-funding my campaign, the only one. I will keep doing, but not worth it. Oh, boy, this is really, well, the word rich keeps coming to my lips. Meanwhile, I was really offended by the placement and reposting of a misleading report on the website of Al Jazeera America. Now, I may be the only one you know who visits that website, but they have some decent reporting on certain issues, and so I check it every day. And back in January, they posted an article on the 21st with the misleading and, well, it's what a lawyer would call a leading question in the headline, which reads, "Is Dark Money Boosting Bernie Sanders?" And I reported this at the time, and I broke it down and ripped it apart for you. The allegation is that Friends of the Earth Action, which has a 501c3 and a 501c4 under the federal tax laws, is using the C4 to raise money and support Bernie Sanders with what's called an independent expenditure. And it's piddling. The total budget, including the production of the TV spot, is $20,000. And Friends of the Earth Action is voluntarily revealing all of the people who donate to this fund. So it's not dark money in any way, shape, or form. They're simply using an entity that is legal. And by the way, Karl Rove finally got approval from the IRS, 501c4 status for his Crossroads GPS. Took him 5 years. And so this is really scurrilous. It's underhanded. And I wrote a letter and emailed it to Al Jazeera. It reads like this. I visit your website every day and saw this story when it was originally posted 2 weeks ago. Today, as New Hampshire votes, you feature it in a display on your site where it stands out. This was a misleading story when it first ran, and it has not been updated or clarified. It's ridiculous to suggest that a group that spends $20,000 and discloses its donors represents dark money, and your headline poses an accusation as a question. I object to this inaccurate reporting that appears to advance Clinton campaign interests. Well, I don't know about you, but all over my Facebook page today, people posted an article from the Village Voice, and it's written by a self-described millennial feminist who uses the name Holly Wood. Now, perhaps that is the name on her birth certificate and driver's license, but I'm just a little bit skeptical of that. I've never heard of Holly Wood or seen her writing before. But wow, is this powerful. I have linked to her commentary in the show file for this podcast, and I strongly encourage you to click on that and read it. Here are a couple of quotes for you. There seems to be no shortage of bizarrely sexist assumptions as to why a millennial feminist am not voting for Hillary Clinton. But speaking as a millennial feminist, let me assure you, none of them is accurate. Granted, the span of my political biography is only as long as it took Howard Dean to go from human rights crusader to insurance lobbyist. That's a great line. But the reason for my political disaffection is plain. I've spent my entire millennial life watching the Democratic Party claw its way up the ass of corporate America. There's no persuading me that the Democratic establishment from where it sits now has the capacity to represent me or my values, and I'm not alone. If millennials are coming out in droves to support Bernie Sanders, it's not because we are tripping balls on geritol. I've never seen that phrasing before, but I think you get what she means. No, Sanders' clever strategy of shouting the exact same thing for 40 years simply strikes a chord among the growing number of us who now agree. Washington is bought, and every time Goldman Sachs buys another million-dollar slice of the next American presidency, we can't help but drop the needle onto Bernie's broken record. The economy is rigged, democracy is corrupt, the billionaires are on the warpath. I mean, this is brilliantly written, I have to say. And I won't read it all to you, but I can't resist a couple of more because she tweaks Paul Krugman, who I have called out in recent weeks for his columns, which clearly support the Clinton campaign. She writes, "And what did the great tawny-bellied Paul Krugman have to say to the nation's waywardly progressive? Sorry," he pecked in his Times column. "There's nothing noble about seeing your values defeated because you preferred happy dreams to hard thinking about means and ends." Pausing to cough up a mouse carcass, he chittered on, "Don't let idealism veer into..." She is so funny. Pardon me. "Don't let idealism veer into destructive self-indulgence." And Hollywood continues here, "I'm trying to imagine an 18th century Krugman admonishing a young Thomas Jefferson against letting his happy dreams of liberty veer into self-indulgence. For good reason, American historians seem unimpressed by Owl's counseling restraint in the face of corruption and oppression." And here's one more quote. "If I am alarmed, it is by the profound languor of the comfortable. What fresh hell must we find ourselves in before those who have appointed themselves to lead our thoughts admit that we are in flames? As I see it, to counsel realism when the reality is fucked is to counsel an adherence to fuckery. Under conditions as distressing as these, acquiescence is absurd. When your nation gets classified as a Class D structure fire, I believe the only wise course is to lose your shit." Okay, Hollywood, you said it. And Chloe is responding very favorably to your ranting there, Hollywood. Russ Baker and his crew at WhoWhatWhy.com have a couple of great stories that I want to refer you to. One is entitled, Can We Trust the New Hampshire Vote Count? Now, at this point, people who are regular listeners to this podcast, for the most part, figure, okay, Sanders is going to beat Clinton, according to the polls, by 15, maybe even 20 points in New Hampshire. But what of the Republican vote count? Well, there are anomalies from the past that give us pause. And at Who, What, Why, Klaus Mare has written a good piece that builds on the work of Bob Fetrakis and Harvey Wasserman in Columbus, Ohio, who have warned about the national pattern of strip and flip. You strip people off the voter rolls for phony reasons, including photo IDs, and then you flip their votes using the unaccountable electronic voting tabulators. And in New Hampshire, the state principally uses AccuVote optical scanners, meaning that voters fill out a paper ballot that is then scanned and counted by a computer. In some of the jurisdictions, they still count the ballots by hand. And back in 2008, I remember this vividly, there were discrepancies in both parties' primary vote counts. Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side and Mitt Romney on the Republican side got consistently higher numbers when machines did the counting and lower numbers when the humans did. And we were concerned that it was stolen from Barack Obama. And there's a whole backstory that a commercial consulting company controls the voting machines in both New Hampshire and Massachusetts, as I recall. And so this article says, without further investigation, foul play cannot be ruled out. And that's why concerned citizens in New Hampshire are petitioning the government to make some simple fixes. Just allow a partial hand count audit in the precincts that are using computer tabulation. Then you compare the hand count with the computer count, and if they are identical, no problem. You've got no fraud. If they're not, well, that is a red flare that should be responded to. And I am very concerned. I continue to be extremely cautious about accepting the vote totals that come from states where we have a one-party rule, including control of the voting process and the counting apparatus. Also at Who, What, Why, Shane O'Sullivan has published a powerful takedown of the conviction of Sirhan Sirhan for the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy back in 1968. And there is a parole hearing in California tomorrow, where most likely Sirhan Sirhan will, for the 14th time, be denied a parole date. And it's because he is notorious and is considered a political prisoner. But one of Kennedy's supporters, who was just a few feet behind him at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles on the night of the shooting, is a 91-year-old man named Paul Schrade. He had been campaigning to, he has for 40 years been campaigning to reopen the case, saying that he was shot in the forehead and nearly died, but that 13 shots and two guns were required to produce all of the ballistics that occurred there. And Schrade says, quote, the LAPD and the district attorney knew 2 hours after the shooting of Robert Kennedy that he was shot by a second gunman, and they had conclusive evidence that Sirhan Sirhan could not and did not do it. The official record shows that the prosecution never had one witness and had no physical or ballistic evidence to prove that Sirhan shot Kennedy. Evidence locked up for 20 years shows that the police department destroyed physical evidence, hid ballistic evidence exonerating Sirhan, and covered up conclusive evidence that a second gunman fatally wounded Robert Kennedy. The autopsy concluded that one bullet passed through the right shoulder pad of Kennedy's jacket without actually entering his body, two bullets hit him under his right armpit, and the fatal shot entered 1 inch behind the ear and went into his brain. So Kennedy was hit 4 times, 5 others were injured, and the LAPD had to account for how 9 shots were fired from Sirhan's 8-shot revolver. So these are very clear, simple contradictions between physical evidence and the court record used to convict Sirhan. And I, for one, have never believed that Sirhan was the sole assassin of Bobby Kennedy. Every day I like to pause for a minute and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. I've had a couple of cancellations from some people who are upset with my coverage of the Oregon standoff and my interview with Todd McFarlane. And I'm sorry to see you canceled, but it's your right. And I, you know, just hope that there are others out there who will see the value of the independent work that I do and the independent views that I bring you and take out a new subscription. So come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the link that says menu. Then you click on Become a Subscriber. On the next page, you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or $50 annual subscription. And hey, no one has signed up yet to earn a bonus gift, a copy of this exciting new book, A Field Guide to the F Word by Ben Parker. And I'd like to send you one. You can put it on your coffee table because there aren't any actual F words in the book. But it's all about the term that starts with F. And I'd like to send it to you. So come on over today, sign up for a new subscription, and join great people like Andy Krieger, Olivier de Merleau in Switzerland. He just signed up. Actually, he sent me a gift recently and has just renewed his annual subscription. Joe Carson is a longtime supporter and a whistleblower from Tennessee. So I want to thank you, you folks who stick with me even when you don't agree. And I encourage those who have not yet supported me to do so and keep this machine going. I want to commend Charlie Savage for an investigative piece, an Enterprise Prize piece, that appeared in Sunday's New York Times. He followed the case of a man who was released from Guantanamo Bay in Cuba a year ago in September. He is a Moroccan named Younes Choukri. And he was uneasy about leaving Guantanamo because they were sending him back to Morocco. And he was reassured that they would probably release him in Morocco within 72 hours of his arrival. But now, some, 15, 17 months later, Choukri is still imprisoned in Morocco. And his lawyers have demanded that the Obama administration press Morocco to live up to what they thought was a deal. But the Obama administration, while I applaud the effort to close Guantanamo, and I know how difficult it is to send prisoners, particularly Yemenis, to places where we claim they can't go, it's really inhumane and just plain obscene to take someone who has been held at Guantanamo without trial or charge on an indefinite basis for over 10 years and then just drop them off someplace and say, "You're on your own, kid." As I've told you, it has happened to a number of former prisoners from Guantanamo that I've talked to. And it's really shameful, but of course, we have no constituency in this country. The Republicans don't want to close Guantanamo, and the Democrats are uneasy about it because they don't want to be on the wrong side of that issue if something goes wrong. And what's doubly infuriating is that Choukri's problem is caused by American intelligence. Because until we released him, the WikiLeaks disclosures by Chelsea Manning show that Americans thought that he might have been involved in efforts to overthrow the government in Morocco before he even went to Afghanistan, which is where we picked him up in 2001. And so it is our information that was probably derived from torture, that was false, that is being used by Moroccan authorities to keep this man behind bars still. It's tragic, and in some respects, words fail me here. President Obama has sent his final annual budget proposal to the Republican-controlled Congress, and the most remarkable part of it, which I have concerns about, is $19 billion in funding for a broad new cybersecurity initiative. Now, the rest of the spending, of course, it's a blueprint that will be changed by the Republicans. They're insulting the president in his final lap here by refusing to allow the budget director, Sean Donovan, to come to the House and testify. That breaks a tradition that's been going on for decades. But the cybersecurity initiative is described as a centerpiece that should garner bipartisan support. This is a 35% increase above current spending, and part of it will be to overhaul the government's aging computer systems to try to prevent future hacking. And we've got more hacking to report to you in just a moment. But as you know, I have grave concerns that much of the hacking that occurs is in response or retaliation to American offensive hacking of other governments and other nations. And so it's very hard to have confidence that we are simply victims of these virulent hackers from other parts of the world. And some sort of an insider apparently got into the files on employees at the Justice Department, the FBI, and the Department of Homeland Security. Now, they're reassuring us that no sensitive information has been stolen, but a hacker posted about 20,000 files on people at the FBI and 9,000 at the Department of Homeland Security. The hacker professes support for pro-Palestinian groups, vowed to make the information public in an apparent attempt to embarrass federal agencies that play a part in cybersecurity operations. So, who's the cat? Who's the mouse? We told you last week that over at the NSA, they're merging the offensive hackers and the defensive hackers, maybe so they'll stop hacking into each other as often as maybe they do now. Two more stories about surveillance. James Clapper continues to serve in disgrace as the top spook in the United States. He's the director of national intelligence who more than 2 years ago perjured himself in testimony before a Senate committee. And he hinted to a separate Senate committee the other day that the so-called Internet of Things, which is a term that's used to describe all of the smart devices that you have, most of which operate on Bluetooth wireless. Well, your home network and any of the toys that you operate, whether it's your garage door, your thermostat, you turn on a coffee maker with a remote control, all of those will be hackable. And Clapper said in the future, intelligence services might use these devices for identification, surveillance, monitoring, location tracking, and targeting for recruitment or to gain access to networks or user credentials. So just keep in mind, as you install the next wave of gadgets in your house, that voice-activated TV system, yeah, Comcast gives me an option to talk to my TV and change the channel, and I turned it off because I don't know when else Comcast would be capturing my comments in my family room. And likewise, Comcast offers the opportunity for you to monitor your own home. You can hook up cameras and then look at them on your smartphone, see if the dog's okay, see if intruders have broken in. And maybe people think that makes them safer, but it allows other people to watch the same cameras, including Big Brother. Now, here in California, a moderate Democrat from Sacramento who serves in the assembly, who's a former cop named Jim Cooper, is carrying a piece of legislation, AB 1681, to loosen the controls on encryption on your smartphone. And this is part of an effort that's also underway in New York State and at the federal level. They desperately want to be able to hack into our phones. And if the government can do it, so can the guy who just hacked into the Justice, the FBI, and Homeland Security departments. And so our government wants us to be completely exposed, to have no privacy. And they use the threats of terrorism to try to justify this. They also distract us by saying, oh, it's only going to be used in the case of a child abduction or sex trafficking or something like that. That's bullshit. because all of the powers that were expanded after 9/11 under the Patriot Act and other legislation are abused because they're not simply used for terrorism-related investigations. And we know that. Meanwhile, you know how they've been talking about how we need to counter the Islamic State and its recruiting, its effective recruiting efforts on the internets? Well, in London today, it was announced that Google has a new plan. For example, if you go on Google and search al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, you'll get search results returned. But along with it will be links, paid links from nonprofit groups, to what they call anti-radicalization messages. So think about this. You go onto YouTube and you want to watch one of the speeches or sermons by Anwar al-Awlaki. We martyred him in Yemen a few years ago in an extrajudicial drone killing. And he is even more popular in death than he was when he was alive. So I search for an Anwar al-Awlaki sermon, and I get it. But also linked might be a video of the beheading of James Foley. Would that be a de-radicalization link? Well, that's how I read it. And I consider this propaganda, plain and simple. And the idea that you can control people's thinking, and that when they have a bad thought and click on a link to ISIS, that you can counter that with what is described as good information? Well, I'm sorry. It's going to be countered with propaganda, with manufactured information, and it's not going to resonate with the people. This is a totally idiotic enterprise. And it shows just how desperate Big Brother has become. Here in California, I want to salute Consumer Watchdog. They've just released a report showing that for the past year, we've been paying higher gasoline prices than the rest of the country. And we knew that. But now we know why. Because last year, it was in February, just a year ago, an Exxon refinery in Los Angeles was crippled by an explosion and fire. That reduced the inventory of refined gasoline in California. Prices went up as the rest of the nation enjoyed declining prices. And then the report does not accuse Exxon and Chevron, these two oil giants, of collusion. But as Exxon supplies were tightening, Chevron started exporting refined gasoline from California. And these twin moves reduced the inventory and drove up the price. So we know we've been gouged. We don't know by exactly how much. But I thank Consumer Watchdog for reporting that to us. And finally today, the airlines, American flagged airlines, are reporting record profits from last year. American Airlines, $7.6 billion, Delta, $4.5 billion, United, $7.3 billion, Southwest, $2.2 billion. And because of those profits, you'd think maybe they're going to get back into competition and lower airfares. Nah. Oh, no. And maybe you'd think they would remove those onerous baggage fees, which, of course, charges a premium for the weakest point of the service offered by the airlines. No, they won't do that. But they are restoring peanut service on many flights, and American Airlines is going to serve free meals on flights between Dallas and Hawaii. Now, I don't want to sound like a geezer here, you know, longing for the good old days. But the travelers on America's airlines we've just become so accustomed to being abused and lied to. And that while you get a low airfare when they add on the seat reservation and the baggage fees and all the other stuff, you got to pay $12 for a hamburger. We're not saving money. We're being exploited and abused. And I'm happy to report that that will continue unabated. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast that you're free to share with absolutely everyone. I hope you will. I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.